If the idea of dying doesn't sit well with you, this episode is for you. Today we're looking at the possibility of a good death. Hello, I'm Mariette Snyman. Welcome to Calm, Clear and Helpful, a weekly podcast series on taking care of yourself and others. Introducing you to a wide range of wellness professionals ready to inform and inspire. Today's topic is taking the edge off dying. My guest is Dr. Rein Strubel, founder and managing director of Geritech, based in Cape Town. Welcome, Rein.
Thank you, Mariette. Wonderful to be with you again.
To our listeners, after our conversation, it will be fun question time. Rein, for those listeners who haven't heard our podcast on dementia, please explain what you do.
So I'm a doctor of gerontology, looking at the psychosocial side of aging. And I have a passion for creating a life worth living for people living with dementia. So I have a private company that provides services to the long-term care sector for older people. And I do a lot of private consulting, helping families and people living with dementia to understand and to create, as I say, a life worth living in spite of the diagnosis, very much focusing on the person behind the diagnosis.
What interested me so was that you've also been trained as a death doula. What is the role of a death doula?
You know, we have a midwife who helps people come into life, creating a good entry. A death doula or an end-of-life doula is a professional who helps people out of life, creating a good death in very simple terms.
Now, death is not a popular topic. It seems that many people, if not most of us, are afraid of death. How does Western society view death?
Yes, it is fascinating for me that death is such a taboo subject. And most of Western society view death with a mix of fear and avoidance and sadly, a desire for medical intervention to prolong life. I think it's very important, and this is where the palliative care experts are so good at saying, you know, when should life not be prolonged anymore? So yes, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of avoidance, and often creating chaos around the actual process of dying, which is very, very sad for me.
I do hope to get more insights from you today, Rein, and I'm sure our listeners will too. So I'd like to ask, what is missing from this view you have just described?
Well, I think the one thing that is missing is that none of us are going to get out of here alive. Okay, so let's start with that. I always, you know, and it's not a joke. I mean, we're not going to get out of this alive. We are all going to die. What is missing from the view is that people think it is something that they can avoid. It is something that happens to older and really frail people. You know, it's going to happen. And it's going to happen to you and me. It happens to children, young people, vibrant people, old people. It is the one thing, as they say, death and taxes. Mm. I mean, people are still able to avoid taxes, but you're not going to avoid death. For me, one of the most beautiful books written on the topic is Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, where he says that somehow our brains are not wired to see ourselves as old, as frail, or to contemplate our own mortality, which is a very interesting thing. It seems that it's almost a way of us to live life without actually contemplating our own mortality. Yeah, we do not want to go around being morbid and depressed about the fact that we're going to die. So the other thing I think that is missing is the beauty of death, and that death teaches us about living. You know, I recently worked with a group of older people where I asked them if they have an advanced directive, and we can talk about that, the difference between an advanced directive and a living will. And I encouraged them to put the advanced directive in a sleeve behind their front door. And the one lady said to me, "No, you know, why behind the front door? Can't we put it in a plastic tube in the fridge, for instance, or in the freezer, or sort of in the back of the freezer?" And I said, "No, I encourage you to put it behind your front door so that every time you leave your house, you think to yourself, what if this is the last time?" A very good friend of mine on a Saturday morning went to put petrol in his car quickly. He was married for 6 months, left the house, and was killed in a car accident. What if it is the last time you leave your front door? I think we would live so differently if we could really contemplate our own mortality, plan for it, discuss it, let everyone know your wishes around how you would wish to die, that you can take control over it. If it's a sudden death, there's very little control over it. Or however, you know, the way we live often, I think, also plays a role in the way that we die. So yeah, death teaches us about living. That is one of the most crucial things that is missing in Western society's view of death.
You've already given me a lot of food for thought. I'm curious, Rain, how has your life and work shaped your outlook on death?
So, Mariette, yes, being involved from a very, very, very early age, and I told you the story that my mother was the matron of an old age home. So being involved from a very early age with death, and especially my mother's way of dealing with it. I remember as a child going home from school for a weekend, and my mother would not be at home. She lived in the old age home. My father lived there for 1 week and said, "I'm out of here." And he rented a little cottage about 36 kilometers away at the coastal village. And we went home to where my father stayed. And my mother would not come home for the weekend. And my father would say, so and so is dying. Your mother is there." My mother would take her knitting and she would sit with the person who was in the process of dying. If they knew that, you know, sometimes people just die suddenly. But she would not let anyone ever die alone if she could help it. And sometimes it would be a week of being with that person. So I think that's where, you know, I became aware of the sacredness of this process. And, you know, the sacredness of being with someone, knowing what those person's wishes are, and helping that person transition. It is the most beautiful thing to witness. Yes, sometimes there is pain. Sometimes it can be traumatic. Sometimes it could be with a lot of pain. But the actual transition is a beautiful, beautiful thing to witness.
My next question is why you became a death doula, but perhaps you have answered part of that already.
Well, being involved with it, seeing it happening, and seeing how clinical it became, you know, how people wanted to, you know, let people die in hospital. They wanted to do everything to extend life. They caused more suffering in their denial of the beauty of the process. That sort of forced me to start the conversation, to say, no, let's talk about it. Let's try and create a different experience. Let's face death, you know, and again, not in a morbid way, but in a realistic way. You know, let's, you know, not leave it for a crisis. Let's, you know, I sat with my parents and my sister in 2016 after a braai, you know, with some good red wine and asked the question, how would you wish to die? Everyone thought I had too much wine. Mm. But we then created an advanced directive for each one of us, and we shared it. And lo and behold, I had to help my father die after a severe stroke and an incredible fight with hospitals and physicians and very clever people who tried everything in their power to keep him alive against his wishes. And I eventually actually got him out of the hospital. Interestingly, the medical aid wouldn't pay for an ambulance to bring him home, in spite of the fact that we were going to save them thousands, if not millions of rands. And I helped my father to die by simply being with them. It was his decision that we withdraw all fluids, all feeding, which is controversial. People do not understand that, you know, giving water or giving food at the end of life could just prolong the life with no quality whatsoever. So, yeah, I was forced in many ways to become engaged, and not against my will, but, you know, this is something that is so crucial that I see and experience every day. And I really, really feel that there is an incredibly valuable role for a death doula to play, to just start the conversation.
I think this is a good place for you to explain to us not only the living will, but also the advanced directive.
Yes, so I always say, you know, a living will is often after the fact. So someone is in a car accident and ambulance comes, take them to hospital, and family lives all over the world. Suddenly there is this telephone call to say, right, you know, someone is on life support. What do we do? And yeah, oh, yes, there's a living will. Where is the living will? Well, it's with the attorneys. Well, the attorney is playing golf or on holiday in Mauritius. Mm. Who knows where the living will is? Chaos. Okay, so the advanced directive is exactly what it says. It is giving a directive in advance. And I carry my advance directive card in my wallet. You know, that's usually the first thing that people look at. Hopefully not the person who steals the wallet at an accident scene, which is so often the case. But to give directions in advance that when I come to the end of my life, whether that is through an accident, through a stroke, devastating stroke, or, you know, I can see that there is no possibility of quality of life after this, that I have given directions. Do not put me on life support. Do not, you know, resuscitate me. And that, even though in our legal system this is not acknowledged yet, there is a lot of work being done in hospitals and with doctors, that more and more doctors and institutions respect the advance directive. For the person who is terminally ill with cancer or whatever, you know, it is so important that before the person loses consciousness, that everyone knows what their wishes are. So this is something that is available on the website of Dignity SA, with a very, very good directive that goes with the advance directive on how to complete it. It is something that you complete with family, with friends. Everyone should know your wishes. A copy with your GP, a copy with your at home with you, your wife, your husband, your children. And that alone, you know, just completing the advance directive actually brings us into the space of thinking of your own mortality. What if this happens to me? What if this situation? How would I wish to be in that situation? It's a lengthy document, but it is so worthwhile, if for nothing other than contemplating, thinking, you know, doing a little bit of introspection. What would I want to happen? Who are the people I want to be with me? And then the advance directive also is a letter of appointment of a medical proxy. So someone who, you know, can make decisions on your behalf when it comes to an end-of-life process. Someone you trust, someone who knows you, obviously someone you've discussed this with. Again, I joke about it and say, you know, don't, you know, if there is a big inheritance, make sure it's not the person who's going to inherit who's your medical proxy. No, it's a very serious appointment of someone who will speak on your behalf. I was my father's medical proxy, my mother's medical proxy. It was clear cut. This exactly the same thing happened with my mother. They phoned the ambulance against her wishes, against our wishes. And she spent the last 12 hours of her life on this earth in an ambulance, being resuscitated, put on life support. But when I arrived the next morning with the advance directive, the doctors were very respectful. And there was no question about switching off life support. And she died 5 minutes later. So I think it is taking that anxiety and often the horror out of family fights and, you know, disagreements. It's the last thing you want for a person at the end of their life and for families. So, yeah, the advance directive starts a conversation. It creates a document with very specific instructions. And the medical proxy can then take control of the situation on your behalf when you can no longer speak for yourself.
Thank you, Rain. I honestly didn't even know about the existence of the advance directive. And I'll also attach the link to that website, Dignity SA, to this podcast.
Absolutely. As I say, there is a guide. It is a lengthy document, but again, I just want to reiterate, you know, just working through that guide brings one to a place of reflection, thinking, how would I wish to be when it comes to the end of my life?
Yes. Now, getting back to a death doula, what are the functions of a death doula?
For me, it starts with this conversation of making people aware. You know, I work, as you know, as we've said, in the aged care sector. So it's often quite a shock for people when you ask them, you know, after we've asked all the 1,000 questions we need to know, have you thought about your wishes for a good death? And people would be shocked and horrified. A lot of people simply will not talk about it, and I respect that. So for me, the role of the death doula starts with this conversation and before any signs of death. And then, you know, usually the death doula's role is when it comes to the end of life, when a person really is now at the point where you can see they're in palliative care, and there is a clear indication, and it is clear most of the time, that they are in the process of dying. The death doula will take on the role of liaising with all the role players. And, you know, there are many rituals that one could do. I can tell you what I did for my father. He loved big band jazz. All my life, I remember my father, his love for big band jazz. So, you know, I had some of his favorite music on my iPad, and I simply put the iPad under his pillow so that sort of there was in the background, there was his favorite music. We know that the color purple has got a spiritual connection. This sounds weird for some people, but, you know, there are a lot of spiritual rituals, depending on how comfortable people feel with it or not, that you could bring into the dying process. You know, one wants to not overstimulate the senses, but also you don't want to smell chemicals and medical smells if you can at all avoid it. So to have the person at home, the death doula will create a calming sensory experience. I burned some orange blossom essential oil. I rubbed my father's feet with lavender oil and just made him as comfortable as possible, guiding people who came to visit. The most incredible thing was that people who came to visit, family members who, you know, came to pray for his recovery. And, you know, before they went into his room, I said, "My father is dying. You can come and say goodbye. Don't wish him, you know, good health. I mean, for goodness sake, let's be honest about what's going on here." And then, you know, we know that after death, clinical death, there is still brain activity for up to an hour after that. So the role of the death doula would be to honor the deceased in a way that we know there is still brain activity. There is still some consciousness in transition. If you could have talked to the person before, you know, you can talk them through the consciousness of this transition. Yes, it's difficult when someone is on morphine or, you know, really drugged. But if you can talk the person through, ask them, what do they see? What do they feel? And just create a sense of comfort in the transition. So I have seen the most beautiful transitions, my father's being one of them. And interesting, you know, I could see the point where this was now the end. And it was so beautiful that I realized, you know, maybe it's a bit inappropriate to play the big band jazz in the mood. And, you know, and I changed the music to Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. And as soon as the second movement started, my father transitioned in the most beautiful, gentle passing on. It was incredibly beautiful. And then we just stayed with him for about an hour before we contacted, you know, the undertakers and whatever. So I think the doula creates that sacred environment in which that person can transition. So whatever it is, and again, if we can discuss it beforehand, do you want music to play? Do you want the family to be around you? Maybe who do you not want to be there? And the death doula can gently guide that person out of the room. My father loved his dog, and the dog was in his arms, in bed with him all throughout the process. And it was fascinating for me to witness the dog's reaction the minute my father transitioned. So, yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful process that the death doula can create for and with the person who is transitioning.
And for those who are there as well, because when I listen to you, you are familiar with this process. You do not fear it, and you are calm and accept it as part of life. And I think that really is what most of us miss about dying.
Yes. I often hear people say, you know, "I've never seen anyone dying." And I think, yeah, you know, we've clinicalized it, we've medicalized it, we've taken it out of life, like we do with birth now. I mean, there are so few natural births. It's all cesarean, you know, it's all clinical. If at all possible, I would want to die at home in my bed, surrounded by my things, and not in a hospital attached to machines. To me, that is a horrible death.
So let's talk about a good death. You have mentioned some characteristics of a good death, but how would you describe it?
So, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that not all deaths are good, that, you know, some people die in pain, in accidents, you know, so it's not always possible to have a good death. But that's why I think, you know, if you can at all plan it, you know, when a person is terminally ill, when we know there is no alternative to then try and create a good death through the wishes of the person who is dying. You know, it is not how I want you to die. It is really, and this is why I think the preparation and the advance directive is so important, is to have the conversation, to contemplate, to think, to plan, if you at all can, to say, well, I want to die at home. I would like to not be sedated, or please sedate me. I want this music to play, or I want it to be silent. For those people who are religious, you know, I would love to have a priest or a pastor there. If it is not a painful death, which is very difficult to avoid, you know, although with palliative care, and I mean the hospice care that is given is absolutely wonderful, but to discuss this. So a good death is to be as much prepared as you can be, to discuss it, to look at the options. You know, what will happen if I stop eating or taking in fluids? What will happen if I take morphine? What will happen if I am on heavy doses of chemotherapy, for instance? What will happen to my body? How will my body react? I know the thing of withdrawing food and fluids, as I said earlier, is very controversial. But we know, as in the case of Sean Davison, the man who started Dignity SA and has been in the news, yeah, with his mother, she had end-stage cancer, and she took a little sip of water every day that kept her alive after stopping all food for 36 days.
Yes.
So, you know, the ideal when it comes to that end of life is to stop all fluid and all food for the body to take its natural course.
Yes.
But, you know, to then start with a nasogastric tube or a PEG feed, in my opinion, is so counterintuitive and counterproductive, because you will simply keep a dying body alive. And that makes no sense to me. Mm. I know the end of life and assisted dying is up again in the courts now. That's not necessarily what I'm advocating for, to end life.
Mm-hmm.
The role of the death doula is to not extend life beyond what is reasonable, or not reasonable even, what is practical. You know, when life is ending, it is ending. The body knows. But to then put in a nasogastric tube or an intravenous drip or a PEG tube is, in my opinion, a lot of people disagree with me, but is very counterintuitive.
When a loved one is dying, Rain, which knowledge or insights can make the process more bearable, especially for those around the person?
You know, again, we do not want to play God, but, you know, the palliative care nurse or the palliative care doctor or the hospice nurse will, you know that this is the end. So I think the most important knowledge or insight is to be honest and open with loved ones, to say, your mother is dying. Okay, that to me, just that fact, that realization, to not at that point try and avoid the topic.
Yes.
I mean, we should have talked about it a long time ago, but if we haven't, to now say, your mother is dying. I find this so interesting how difficult it is for some medical professionals to actually utter these words. And I think it's the biggest gift you can give at this point, is to say, your mother is dying. Right. Now, what will happen? What could this look like? We don't know necessarily how long this will take. But from the time we stopped all food and water with my father, which was Wednesday afternoon, he died on Saturday evening. Now, my father was as strong as an ox at 85, but there were no signs of distress or discomfort. You know, it was just a beautiful slow process of transitioning. Sometimes, you know, there could be an excretion of bodily fluids and whatever, but to prepare the family and everyone and say, this is what is going to happen. But to start with acknowledging, right, we are now at the point where this person is actually dying. We are not going to intervene. This was the person's wishes. We will keep their mouth moist. We will clean their mouth. And we will simply keep them as comfortable as possible. I don't think there is more than that. If, of course, there are certain medical conditions, you know, there might be bodily reactions, and that should also be discussed. But, you know, what will happen if we switch off life support? How long will it take? Well, for my mother, it was 5 minutes. You know, it could be immediate. So just discuss that as openly as possible with what we know. There's a lot we don't know, and be honest about that as well. But we can absolutely say that when a person is not being given any fluid or food, it is a short period of time.
And Rain, if, say, someone is listening whose loved one would not at all be willing to discuss death, is there any guidance for this person to help them talk to the loved one?
You know, Mariette, I think this is a very interesting question, because our challenge is not only around death. Our challenge is around the diagnosis of cancer, the diagnosis of dementia, you know, the having to move to a care home. We are so bad at talking things through. And it's no use trying to put someone in a corner and lecture them. So my advice would be to test the water, ask questions rather than give instructions. You know, how do you feel about the diagnosis? You know, what do you think is going to happen? So that appreciative inquiry in kindness and with gentleness, but if a person doesn't want to talk, it's a very, very difficult, pardon the pun, deadlock. Yeah, I don't have advice for that. And I come across it all the time, that people simply are not prepared to talk about their mortality.
I can't help thinking about our previous podcast, which was about how to communicate with someone living with dementia. Which I've been thinking about very often since, because you talked about being deeply present and developing the ability to be deeply present. And I suppose if one develops one's own ability of being deeply present with your loved one who doesn't want to talk about death, who knows that over a long period of time the chance might not come.
So that is absolutely true, Mariette. And as I said then as well, the biggest gift you can give anyone, not necessarily a dying person or a person living with dementia, is your presence. And my advice would be for the person, and this is often a suffering, the person suffering with cancer and chemo, to just simply be there. Do not make demands. Do not ask questions. As I say, don't put the person in a corner. Simply assure them with your presence of your presence. I am here. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to say anything. Simply the biggest gift is your presence, your loving, gentle presence. You don't have to talk. You don't have to have ideas. You don't have to do anything. Just be there. That is, in my opinion, the biggest gift you can give.
Yeah. A quick note on what I do. I'm a content entrepreneur creating podcasts and articles on living a happier and healthier life by interviewing coaches, therapists, and other wellness experts from over the world. You'll find this content on my website, www.mariehetsneeman.co.za, and it's there to help you find just the right helping professional when you need one. The section Up Close and Personal on my website offers you a glimpse of the person behind many of the experts I feature. If you're a wellness expert keen on getting more in-person or online clients or creating worldwide awareness of an issue close to your heart, let's talk about co-creating a podcast or article, or perhaps featuring you in a South African magazine. You'll find more information under Services on my website. Now, back to my guest. Where can listeners learn more about your work?
I think, there are a few platforms, but this particular one is my blog called Minds Matter. So it's simply www.mindsmatter.co.za. I talk about death, dying, dementia, and a lot of other fun things in between. But Minds Matter is my blog where I have documented my father's death, my mother's death, and some deaths in between. I think, yes. And there are a lot of, Dignity SA. There are a few other death doulas like Keshni Marty doing a lot of wonderful work. There are death cafes. I host a monthly death over dinner. We're a group of about 15 people, and we get together once a month, the last Wednesday of the month, and we cook wonderful food, drink lots of wine, and talk about death. So, and it is not morbid. Oh, yes, we cry. But my goodness, we laugh and we share stories and we learn so much. Invite people for dinner and say, I know we're not allowed to talk about politics, but let's talk about death.
Mm.
Have you got an advance directive? Have you got a will? Never mind an advance directive. How many people don't have a will? Be controversial. Bring it out of the closet.
Yeah, that sounds like an interesting challenge. I wonder how many of us will take that one up.
I would love to know. I'd love to know people's feedback. How do they feel about this? I think the sacredness of life is epitomized in death. And if we really take life seriously, which we all should, and I think a lot of people do, then, how can we not talk about death?
True. Now to end on a lighter note, Rain, not that this has been a morbid discussion at all, may I ask you a fun question?
Yeah, absolutely.
If you were a bench, Rain, offering people the opportunity to sit down and rest, what would you look like and where would you be placed?
I'm a couch bench person, so my bench would be in a park under a beautiful oak tree. And it wouldn't be a park bench. It would be one of those, can I use the word fat sack?
Yeah.
Okay, everyone knows what a fat sack is. It would be the kind of soft climb into fabric bench, couch, where people can flop into, feel hugged, so that you can lie on your back and look at the dappled sun through the leaves of the tree, see the changing in seasons, knowing, contemplating that for everything there is a season. So it would be a very comfortable, deep sagging into hugging type of bench couch that you could flop into.
That sounds like the perfect place to come home to.
I'm a big hugger, so this would be your hug under the tree.
Oh, thank you, Rain, and thank you for sharing your insights and your heart on this sensitive topic. I must say that I feel more hopeful after listening to you, so thank you.
Thanks, Mariette. And I think in terms of three tips, it would be great if you could put the link to the advanced directive. And my first tip would be to just absolutely take a minute to download this thing. Okay?
Yes.
Just download it. Okay? Put it on your desk. You're going to discover it again in a few weeks' time. But just download this thing.
Mm.
My second tip would be drop that bomb at a dinner party or while you're standing around the fire at the braai, ask your friends, ask your family, have you thought about the way you would like to die if you could at all have a say in it? You know, just be controversial. And it's not controversial. I mean, it is such a not a controversial thing. But be that person to actually open the conversation. You might, you know, get a wonderful surprise at where this leads to. And my third tip is make sure someone has got the passwords to your computer and the PIN to your cell phone. If something suddenly happens, it causes chaos when no one can access your bank account detail or your computer password or your phone PIN. So if you're not prepared to go the advanced directive route or whatever, at least have the common sense and the good manners to be a little bit more prepared. Because, as we said, none of us is getting out of here alive.
True. Thank you, Rain. And to our listeners, it was good of you to join us. I'd love you to subscribe to this podcast series. And if you found this episode helpful, please share it with someone you care about. Go to my website, www.marietsneeman.co.za, for this episode's podcast notes. And for free articles and podcast episodes on how to live a happier life and have more fulfilling relationships. To follow me on Facebook, just search for Mariette Sneeman, journalist. Calm, Clear and Helpful is compiled, hosted and edited by me, with original music by Mart Marie Sneeman. Catch you next Tuesday at 9:00.